Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. What do you get when you mix romance with a pressing story about the environment with a memoir of life in western Kansas? The answer is a new book, The Ogallala Road, a memoir of love and reckoning by Julene Bear. The book is a highly readable account of life in western Kansas that stands to disappear forever if the projections prove right. Those projections suggest that the Ogallala Aquifer that provides water for irrigation in Kansas and seven other states, running from South Dakota all the way to Texas, 174,000 square miles worth, is running dry. If it goes, so does much of the heartland as we know it. Julene Bear has recorded all this in the Ogallala Road. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, USA Today, and the Chicago Tribune. She's also the author of One Degree West, and she's a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And so good to have you here, Julene. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, over the course of your life, you've had this on-again, off-again relationship with the land of western Kansas. Why is that?
Well, I think when you grow up in a place where there's so much land and you can see so far, you are very much influenced by that type of environment. I was accustomed to sunshine all the time and lots of prairie grass and pastures and horses, and it was a good life in my childhood. I left it.
I was going to say you left.
At a fairly young age. At age 18, I took off for more exciting things, I thought at the time. But
as kids are wont to do. Yeah.
Exactly. But it turns out that I had been pretty, my identity had actually been forged by that place. I just didn't realize that at the time.
How so, do you think?
Well, I think because we had an intact family living in a community, in a rural landscape where we interacted with not very many people, but having just a few neighbors that you knew really well, I was just very rooted in that life. And my father was an excellent farmer. I had two wonderful parents. And the life we were living was kind of the only life that seemed normal, really. My father thought that farming was the only really, truly valid occupation. And I think that sort of sunk into me.
I think I like him already. That sounds like a neat thing to say. And we're talking about the Goodland area, way out in western Kansas, right? Not far from the border of Colorado.
That's right.
A lot of Kansas Cityans know it when they zip past on I-70.
Right. Goodland is on I-70, and I lived 20 miles northwest of Goodland.
All right. You do such a great job describing the land out there and what that meant to you. Describe the land for us. What's it like out there?
Well, as I said, it's very open and airy. The air is dry because we're west of the 100th meridian. And as a consequence, the colors are more muted, subtle greens, not this blatant kind of jade or emerald green that you see when you come further east. And I think that quality of pastels, there's a lightness about it and a subtlety about it, and it gets into the spirit.
A lot of city folks don't have patience for it.
Well, that's right. And then, of course, life in the fast lane feels a little too fast for me. I'm a little more rooted in a quiet lifestyle.
That's what you prefer now.
That's right. Even though I can negotiate city traffic all right, and I lived in San Francisco for 12 years, I still prefer the more quiet existence.
That'll amaze a lot of people that you've given up San Francisco, which for my money is the great American city, for something so different than that.
Actually, when I left San Francisco, I was about 30 years old, and I headed off for an even more remote place. I went to live in the Mojave Desert Mountains by myself in a little stone house that a World War I veteran had built. And it needed a lot of refurbishing, which I did, and I loved living alone out there. I was surrounded by five mountain ranges, and there was always some new territory to explore.
Why did you do it at that age?
I fell in love with the desert, and I think that was that forged identity I talked about earlier, coming back to the surface again. I had been living in the city for a number of years, and then I started going camping, and it got so I didn't really want to go back to the city. It was hard for me to return.
People will wonder, what did you do out there?
by yourself.
Well,
in the
I thought
Mojave
I was
desert.
Going to. I thought I was going to be this modern day Thoreau.
We all think that at some point, don't we?
Well, I thought in a year or two, probably I'd be publishing in the New Yorker and I'd be this successful writer. So I sent my stories off. Very first story I wrote, I sent off to the New Yorker and to the Atlantic and got my rejection slips, and then they sort of mounted up over time. Pretty soon I had tacked them up and wallpapered my outhouse with them.
How did you handle that?
Well,
you obviously came back with a couple of books, including The Ogallala Road.
Yeah, those early rejections were a little bit hard to take, but as you live the life of a writer, you realize that's just all part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
You just keep getting better, trying to take the advice you get from editors when you're lucky enough to get the advice, and you just keep working on perfecting your art, and eventually you begin to publish a little bit.
For you, Julene, what kind of advice, what kind of counsel did you receive from editors? What were they saying about your writing that you thought, okay, I've got to work on this?
The most interesting, probably the first real advice I got from an editor was on a piece I had written about my father. And at that point, I was seeing my father at a great distance. I hadn't lived with him or near him as an adult. So I had this sort of heroic vision of him. And this editor wrote in the columns, was it all good? Was there anything that flawed about this man? And that just triggered me. And I started, well, as a matter of fact, at the very same time, that was about when I moved back home to Kansas. And now I knew my father in a way I never had as an adult, and I indeed did see his flaws.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was actually able to portray him in as a more endearing character because he was human.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little more about your mom and dad, because, again, they're players in this book, and I want you to describe them for our listeners because, again, your father particularly is such an intriguing guy to me.
Well, they were your classic husband and wife on the farm. My mother was a housewife, and the gender roles were very strict. She was playing the supportive role to my father. He was a charismatic man. He had a good sense of humor. His energy level was just so vibrant, and he was so strong. And I think I write in the book somewhere that determination was almost a physical quality. It's what you saw it kind of breathe out of the way he walked. And he always got in the field when he needed to get in the field. He wouldn't wait. He didn't go to church on Sundays because he wanted to make sure that, you know, he got his crops in. And also he was not a religious man, which was kind of unusual for that territory.
Where did his interest in farming come from? What was it about farming that drew him in so deeply?
You know, he had six siblings, and of them all, he was the only one who really had farming in his blood. The others did farm some, but for him, it's all he ever wanted to do. And he went away to college, but he studied agriculture at college. And so he came home a little more scientifically minded and eager to try things like he raised sheep, for instance, whereas this was cattle country. But he had learned in college that he could make more money on sheep, and he also got very interested in them.
And did he?
Yes, he did very well with sheep. He had 1,000 ewes at one point, and every spring there would be 1,200 lambs.
Wow. That's a neat sound, I bet.
Yeah, it is, all that buying life.
Yeah.
And
how about your mom? Tell us about her.
Well, she liked science. She was interested in reading books.
Mm-hmm.
She was a very interesting mixture because she also read this magazine called Fate Magazine, and it was about all the weird things that happen, you know, UFOs and ghosts and things like that. She enjoyed that. But at the same time, she often would say that she saw no conflict between science and religion, that we had evolved over time, but that was equally marvelous.
That's a lot of folks look at it that way.
Right.
Yeah. Your parents lived on property that their parents had sort of staked out and started. Tell us about that.
My parents grew up 5 miles apart. And
wow.
I don't think they actually knew each other because they went to different schools until they were teenagers. And then when they were 20, when my mother was 20 and he was 25, they were married.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they came out to how soon did they come out to the farm where you grew up?
Well, my mother grew up on that farm herself, and then my father's farm was only 5 miles away. So they owned some land in a different part of the county, but then when my grandfather died, they needed someone to take over the farming, and my father was the likely candidate.
And you were determined to keep that farm in the family when it got to that point in your life. Why?
Well, my father always said, hang on to your land.
Yeah.
That was his first principle, his main commandment. And he said it because he thought it was practical. He thought that the land would always be there. If you sold the land, you would have cash that might just run through your fingers. There were a couple of examples of that in our family. Siblings of my father and mother who had sold their land and then lost their money. So there were plenty of examples of that.
Let's move on to the story that you tell in this book, and let's touch on the romance. And then let's go to your son, and let's go to the aquifer itself a little later on. In this book, you meet a man named Ward. He's a rancher who lives in the Smoky Valley, and that's this area of rolling hills. That's one of the few remaining areas of grasslands, here in the heartland. Now, you met him quite by accident. How did it happen that day?
I had gone back to western Kansas. At that point, I was living in Laramie, Wyoming, and I had gone back there in order to explore the watershed. I wanted to see if I could find any of the springs that I had read used to supply water to the Native Americans, going all the way back to Paleolithic times. I was concerned that those springs were drying out. I had, in fact, read that over 700 miles of Kansas creeks and rivers had dried out.
And so you wanted to check it out for yourself.
Right. And I also knew I wanted to write about the aquifer, but I was looking for inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't exactly know how to start.
Did you find it in Ward?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, yes, I the name of that section of the book is called A Rare Find, mm-hmm. and there were actually two rare finds. I did find a spring that day. It was much diminished, of course, from what it had originally been.
Because you were able to recall it from your own childhood, right?
No, I had never gotten out that far in my childhood. Being a girl, I sort of hung close to home. I wasn't nearly the explorer that my brother Bruce was, who knew the county like the back of his hand.
Mm-hmm.
But this was based on my reading. That is kind of how I do tend to come toward things. I find out about something in a book, and then I go look for it on the land. So that's what I was doing, and I did find one of those springs where settlers had also built their homesteads.
And what you also were finding, though, were lots and lots of dry creek beds, right?
Right.
I mean, just one after the other.
Right. Now, the creek beds in western Kansas have always been primarily dry, but there's also been a lot of spring-fed creeks and rivers, such as the Smoky Hill River, mm-hmm. the Republican River. Those are both spring-fed rivers. The Smoky Hill now is practically dried up.
And that's a result of the aquifer getting so low.
That's groundwater pumping,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to see if I could find a spring. I thought maybe the water would tell me what to say. You know,
mm-hmm.
it was all very important to me, but I didn't know how to make it important to other people.
And so you were walking on land that wasn't exactly your land.
No.
You weren't exactly where you were supposed to be.
No. That's not that big of a deal out there. Having grown up out there, I wasn't that uncomfortable with doing that.
But you were a little embarrassed.
A little bit,
yeah.
Because what happened was I did find the spring, and there was a cottonwood tree beside it, and I decided I needed some shade. It was a hot August afternoon.
Cottonwood always being a sign that maybe water's nearby.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah. The leaves of a cottonwood even make the shimmering sound, this rattling sound that's sort of like water running.
Mm-hmm.
So they really are a sign of water. And I was sitting under the tree, and I heard this clanging noise, which was familiar to me. It was the sound of a pickup pulling a metal stock trailer down the hill. And I was embarrassed. I mean, I was out there in the middle of this guy's pasture, you know. How was I going to explain that? I considered jumping into the ravine, but that would have been sort of ridiculous because he would have seen me. And so...
Yeah, it might have changed your life, yeah, in other ways, yeah.
Right. So I just stood up, and... he introduced himself, and then we started talking. And before we had talked for long,
he recognized your name. He recognized your work.
He actually recognized both from the way I was talking. I think he picked up on my concerns, and also from the way I looked. There had been a picture on the back of my last book, and he said, "Hey, you're the woman who wrote that book." Well, this was very surprising to me because. As far as I knew, the only people who had read that book had been maybe my high school English teacher. I knew she had, and my fourth grade teacher. I knew she had, and my mother.
And so you immediately thought, this guy can't be half bad. He's read my book.
Oh, immediately. That was the door was open,
yeah.
You know. So, and he said he had liked it so much. It reminded him of the last picture show, and he wanted to know if he had even considered writing to me through my publisher.
Yeah. And so here you are sitting out in this pasture way out in the middle of nowhere, and you meet this sort of this kindred spirit.
Right. I was a little bit resistant, though, because he was a cowboy, and I had opinions about cowboys based on my marriage to my son's father, which hadn't gone too well.
And he was a cowboy.
He had been a cowboy,
mm-hmm.
Right.
So you thought, I don't want to go down that road again.
Right. I thought I could see right through him. I just thought I knew that whole mindset, and I didn't think that I could be interested in another one like that, another cowboy.
Well, so you talk, and he goes away, and maybe you're thinking what at that point when you part?
Well, at that point, the conversation had evolved to where I realized that he had a similar interest in history. We
mm-hmm.
talked about Pedro de Castaneda, who had explored the plains, and we had talked about other books that we shared an interest in, and so I was interested at that point. And he now had my address. He had said, "Oh, I'll send you some articles on the Ogallala Aquifer if there are any in the local newspaper."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Okay." And it was only a matter of days before I had a letter from him.
Oh, there you go. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking with author Julene Bear about her new book, The Ogallala Road, A Memoir of Love and Reckoning. It's a book that combines all sorts of different elements, romance, a tale about her son, and the plight of the Ogallala Aquifer out in western Kansas that's so important to all of us out here. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number, 816-235-2888. And I should point out that Julene Bear will be speaking tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Country Club Plaza. To grab a seat, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, that number, 913-384-3126. Let's turn now, we'll come back to the romance. Let's turn now to your son, Jake. You desperately wanted a father for him at that point in his life. Why?
Well, I was a feminist. I didn't think that my son would necessarily need a father, but life had taught me to look at this a little bit differently. For one thing, when my son was very young, less than 2 years old, he gravitated toward men. He tried to go home with his best friend's dad at the daycare.
Wow.
Later, when he was a little older, when the UPS man came to the door, he would say, "Well, why don't you marry that guy?" So, of course, I wished and wanted to find someone, but I didn't make it the focus of my attention. At this point in his life, however, he was in his rebellious teen years, mm-hmm. and he was becoming a bit much to handle, and I felt that he needed another parent. It didn't necessarily have to be a man, mm-hmm. just someone else who cared about him to the extent I did. And I being heterosexual, the obvious choice was mm-hmm. I did hope that someday I would meet someone, but I'd sort of given up on that as a likelihood.
Mm-hmm. And the struggles he was having were struggles like what?
He was not that interested in school. Mm-hmm. When he went to work, he had the greatest job for a teenager in Laramie. He worked at the Wyoming Territorial Prison as a gunslinger for tourists. His yeah. job was to pretend that he was in a shootout and do that 10 times each day. And he wouldn't go to work. You know, he just didn't care. He was a punk rock drummer, which was the one thing he took a lot of interest in. So I actually encouraged that because it was good that he was taking an interest in something.
Let's turn to the aquifer itself, because these concerns you have about the aquifer are so real. You know, we hear a lot about this, the plight of the aquifer out here in eastern Kansas, but a lot of folks, you know, aren't paying a whole lot of attention. But the drying up of this big underground reservoir is a huge deal. Tell us about that.
Well, that reservoir grows 30% of the irrigated crops in this country.
30%.
Right.
Hang on to that number, folks. It's a big number.
Right. But a lot of the crops it grows are just patently unsuited for that climate, and consequently they need a lot of irrigation water, more than some other more drought-tolerant crops.
Crops like corn, right?
Right. This is corn that I'm thinking of primarily, because there's been such an expansion of corn acreage lately. Mm-hmm. So that's placing the highest demand on the aquifer. If we do not make a conversion back to dry land crops soon and preserve the water in the aquifer, then there will be none left to do what the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change tells us that we're going to need to do, and that is augment even the crops that grow traditionally as dry land crops in a region with some irrigation water.
So this notion that, you know, okay, it's been dry out there for a few years, and, you know, folks know that, and some people might think, well, just everybody relax. It'll start raining again someday, and the thing will fill back up, and this concern will go away in 3 or 4 years. You say what to that?
Well, the aquifer doesn't work like that. It's been on a steady decline ever since pre-development, well, from the day that we started irrigating. In western Kansas, that was in the 1960s. Since what they call pre-development, we have gone through 30% of the water. This is according to a study by Kansas State University that came out just recently. It's predicted that if we continue using water at this rate, within 50 years, by 50 years from now, we will have used 70% of the water.
And so when folks out there dig wells, does it make a difference in terms of how deep they have to go these days to get to the water?
They do have to go a little bit deeper. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that was a shock to me as I was researching this book, and I do write about it. I was surfing the web one day trying to see what had happened to the wells in our region, and I had learned that there were observation wells that the Kansas Geological Survey tests every year. It turned out that our well was one of those. So I was able to see, and I started to say black and white, but it turned out it was blue and white. It was a graph with a blue line indicating water, and the line was just going down very precipitously. We had lost something like, I think it was 15 feet in our well at that time, and I computed that we had used up 25% of the saturated depth of that well.
What did your father used to say to you about all this, though? He had a different attitude about it.
Well, actually, my father understood that the aquifer was finite.
Yeah.
He knew that we would use it up someday, but his attitude was, well, until the government, and he called the government Big Daddy, he said, well, don't worry, because I would complain to him. And he would say, don't worry, Big Daddy will put the plug in before it's too late. And then he'd say, but until then, I got mine. And he would do that just to get my goat.
Mm-hmm.
There was some truth to that. That was indeed his sentiment.
And maybe a lot of farmers out there and ranchers sort of feel the same way.
Well, certainly. I mean, it's like any other business. They're allowed to do it. It's considered sane business practice. It's condoned. So they're doing it until it's not legal to do it.
Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Again, our guest, Julene Baer, the author of The Ogallala Road, A Memoir of Love and Reckoning. Steve from Lee Summit. Steve, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Three quick questions.
Yes, sir.
One would be, how do you feel about the XL pipeline, and have you talked with any geologists about it? What's their opinion? Number two is, has there been any tests on that water through the years, whether it's picking up pollutants?
I think the answer to that is yes, but yeah.
And then does that at its maximum height, I know it comes up to the Missouri River or Kansas River, does it get seepage into the river when it gets to, when it was at a maximum height? I don't know if that was even discernible, but those three questions.
Yeah. Okay, Steve, I appreciate it.
Well, those are really good questions.
How about the XL pipeline?
Well, yes, first of all.
Huge controversy around this thing that will go right through the heart of Kansas, yeah.
I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about the pollution of the aquifer and tied it to the debate about the Keystone Pipeline. I do believe that the pipeline would be terrible for that region of the aquifer that it goes over, because if it, and indeed if it goes over the sand hills, as it's still planned to do, as I understand, that if there were a break in that pipe, it would indeed go into the aquifer faster in the sand hills than it would anywhere else. Because
it goes through the sand more quickly. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the lateral travel would also be faster there because it's sand, and it would probably get into creeks and rivers in that area. It is not true that if there were a break in the Keystone Pipeline, it would pollute the entire aquifer. The aquifer is made up of saturated sands and gravels and rock, and it's like a giant sponge. And the lateral travel in most areas is something like 1 foot a year. It just doesn't travel sideways that
much. So if it gets down there, getting it out would be extraordinary.
Getting it out would be a total nightmare, and it would already would have polluted streams and so on. And I think it's very likely that it will break from the evidence of other pipelines in other parts of the country.
Hmm. How about tests on the water now? Is it picking up any pollutants now, Steve wanted to know.
Right. The U.S. Geological Survey does do tests. I think they determined that 14% of the wells in there that they were testing, and that's a number, I can't tell you how many, had atrazine in them.
That is
a herbicide
from fertilizer,
that is used
yeah.
primarily on corn,
mm-hmm.
right? And it would be best to check my New York Times article on these numbers, because I don't necessarily remember them exactly anymore. The nitrates are definitely a problem, too. That's from all the chemical fertilizers that we're using. And those numbers are creeping up the charts as time goes by. And it's called non-point source pollution, and it's spread all over any area that's farmed.
How about seepage into the Kansas and Missouri rivers from the aquifer itself?
I think it would get there through the other streams that are mm-hmm. out in that region. The Republican will feed into the Kansas, isn't it? I believe. Okay.
Yeah. Any
stream that's still flowing out there is going to flow into these rivers in the eastern part of the state. And that's a problem, of course, because the rivers aren't flowing well. The Republican is now flowing very well, and I'll tell you why. It's because Kansas sued Colorado and Nebraska, and Colorado, in order to settle that suit, closed down hundreds of irrigation wells, and they also opened the floodgates at Bonnie Dam.
Steve, thanks for the question. Let's go to Leo from KCK before a break here. Leo, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Leo.
I'm fascinated by this. First of all, I live right on the Kaw, and the Kaw is formed by the confluence of the Smoky Hill and the Republican, I believe. But I grew up in central Kansas,
mm-hmm.
and out there is it's a watershed district. It's the Wet Walnut Watershed District, and it's supposedly one of the largest watershed districts in the country. And there is some controversy out there about how the watershed district is affecting the availability of groundwater in that part of the state. And I wondered if your guest had any comments or feelings about that.
I don't know that district. Is it on the Ogallala?
No, it actually spans the entire state of Kansas down the area they call the Walnut Valley, which is pretty much right down to the middle of the state.
Okay.
West to east.
Yeah, all I know is that groundwater pumping does indeed affect stream flow almost everywhere that it takes place.
Well, I knew it was kind of a crapshoot whether you'd be aware of it or not, but I thought it was worth asking about.
Okay.
I'm really enjoying your conversation this morning.
I'm glad you called, Leo.
Educational.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our talk about the Ogallala Road. We'll talk about Julene's romance here, and we'll talk about a whole bunch more. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Well, this hour we're visiting with Julene Baer. She's the author of The Ogallala Road, a memoir of love and reckoning. She speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Country Club Plaza. To grab a seat, call Rainy Day Books and Fairway, 913-384-3126. You know, Julene, to what extent are the farmers and ranchers out there not only aware of the problem, I'm sure they're aware of the potential issues with the aquifer, but how much are they worried about it? How much are they responding to it in terms of different methods of farming? And what do you make of the involvement of Governor Brownback and state government who's made this a priority as he goes forward in his administration?
Well, taking your last question first,
yeah.
Governor Brownback has made some good changes in water law. Now you no longer have to use or lose your water right. It used to be if you didn't use your entire appropriation, then you would get cut back.
It would be measured somehow?
Yes. Originally, we didn't even have meters on our wells, but now we're required to have meters on the wells. So you can easily measure how much water you use each year, and if you overuse, then you're fined.
Hey, how much water did your farm use in a typical year? You have some interesting figures in the book about this.
There was a range, but
a
kind of average was about 200 million gallons.
200 million gallons.
That's right.
One farm
right.
in Kansas.
And it was just a middling large farm. It wasn't a huge farm. We had 5 irrigation wells.
Yeah. I'm scrambling, searching through my notes here. You had a number 2 for the typical bushel of corn, which was how
well,
much?
Well, that wasn't actually a typical bushel.
Okay.
But that was one year when we were flood irrigating. That was back before we had center pivot sprinklers.
Yeah.
And I did the computations for my father for the water report that year. And it turned out that year we had used 4,000 gallons for every bushel of corn we grew. Now, I have since read that a more average figure with sprinkler irrigation is about 2,500 gallons.
Hmm. So farmers and ranchers are responding how? What do you see happening there? Are they making changes or is
right.
it more gradual than maybe you prefer?
Well, there's actually very few farmers who've just independently said, I'm not going to do this anymore because it's turning away an incredible profit. I mean, when you irrigate, that's 2/3 of your income usually is coming from irrigating.
Irrigated crops you're
right.
talking about, the
so
result
if,
from that. Yeah.
Right. If you were dryland farming, you would only make maybe 1/3 as much.
And what's the difference between irrigated farming and dryland farming? Explain
right.
that to me.
Well, dryland farming, I love the definition of it that comes from this historian of the plains called, his name was Walter Prescott Webb. He defined dryland farming as the science of farming where rainfall is deficient.
Mm-hmm.
So in places where there's not enough rain, people have adapted. They've learned how to preserve the moisture in their soil. And my father was very good at that, and so were all of his neighbors. We were actually quite prosperous before we started irrigating.
You preserve the moisture in the soil how?
Well, it involves different implements that you use and also fallowing the ground. So we would have a wheat crop one year, then we would leave the stubble on, and the stubble would collect the rainfall. And then we would have to come through and undercut the stubble in order to kill the weeds because weeds will rob moisture from the soil. But then you try to leave as much stubble on it as possible up to close to harvest because that organic matter on the surface was helping you collect water and protecting the topsoil.
But bottom line, you're saying is that the dryland farming, you know, in terms of profit, it just ain't there.
Well, not compared to this false economy we're living in now where we have we have a very high corn price because of ethanol. There's a renewable fuel standard that is requiring more and more ethanol be mixed with our gasoline each year, and most of our ethanol comes from corn.
Mm-hmm.
So that the price shot up. It went up to $8, which was about three times as much as the price they were getting prior mm-hmm. to that. So that incentive is definitely at work here.
And it's real money.
It's real money, yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to turn your back on.
You also had to wrestle with this notion out there, Julene, of chemicals.
Right. My father very cavalierly sprayed chemicals on everything. It was all I could do to keep him from not spraying the weeds in my yard.
Mm-hmm.
He just couldn't imagine anybody not wanting to spray weeds. Yet, more and more, we're seeing these epidemiological studies where people are getting cancer, children are dying because when they're in their growing stages, they adapt, the poisons go into their system more quickly than in adults.
Yeah.
I mean, the data is out there if you want to access it, and it's quite dangerous to be using those chemicals.
So at one point late in the book, you and your brother are wrestling with numbers, and you're looking at what makes sense for your farm and what doesn't. You're obviously concerned about the aquifer. And I think sometimes, Julene, and you know, the city folks, I think we tend to forget how much goes into running a farm these days. You have a paragraph late in the book that really caught me, and the paragraph goes like this. My brother sent me an Excel worksheet listing everything it took to grow dry land winter wheat, the cost of the fuel, the rate our tractors consumed it by the hour, the number of hours in each field operation, and equally exacting particulars for every other expense imaginable, crop insurance, property taxes, maintenance, custom cutters, and the one thing I hoped we'd be able to do without, chemicals. So lots of costs on top of costs.
Mm-hmm.
And you learned what from going through all that?
Well,
once you added up the numbers.
I learned that we couldn't support as many people as we were supporting if we went over to dryland farming. Our farm at that point was supporting my mother, my brother's family, and me and Jake. And if we went over to dryland farming, then we would not be able to extend the money beyond the people who were farming it, which at that point I hoped would be Ward and me.
Mm-hmm. And so you did what with that information?
I decided that it was going to be too much of a sacrifice for everyone in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And we started looking more seriously at the possibility of selling the farm.
Hmm. What about Ward himself and how your relationship with him changed during the course of this book? And where are you today?
Well, Ward and I had some differences. He was very conservative politically. But we also came from a background in Kansas from a time when Kansas was much more mainstream than it is today, and political differences were not quite so exaggerated. So we felt that we could talk through those differences, and to some extent we did. We learned from each other.
Mm-hmm.
Our minds expanded around, you know, opinions that we didn't think it was possible to have that happen with.
Mm-hmm.
But gradually, I guess it would be giving away the end of the book if I told you.
You don't need to do that.
I don't need to tell you exactly what happened.
Because you build up here a little bit.
But there were some there definitely were some challenges.
Mm-hmm. There always are.
Yes, that's for sure.
And they continue for all of us. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But really, he and I share so much place sense. It was amazing to be involved with a man who actually came from the same type of territory that I came from and had all the cultural givens and the givens of the landscape itself.
And how much impact did he have on your son, Jake?
Jake was very endeared to Ward. The first thing that Ward and he ever did together was he took him out to go shooting. Of course, I'm not crazy about guns. You know, I shot them when I was a kid, and I just never really got into hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just given my son my father's rifle, his prized Remington, and Ward took him shooting that day. It was in December, and the ponds were frozen over on his farm. And they would throw rocks across the pond and then shoot them on the go or on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
And Jake came home so proud of himself because he'd managed to hit those rocks.
Mm. Good for him.
It was good for him to have that type of an experience.
That's a moment, isn't it,
mm-hmm.
for a mom? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Let me read an email we have here from Tim from Platte Woods emailed this. It was 1983, and one of my students did a paper on the Ogallala Aquifer, and it was spot on in its predictions. Her research indicated that in two or three decades, there would be a real problem in supplying these agricultural state with water. And I'm just wondering, as you complete this book and you look at the future when it comes to the Ogallala, you're thinking what? What kind of peril might we be in as you look at the across the landscape of this state?
Well, if we keep going at this rate, we will have a crash landing. I mean, mm-hmm. some people have already crash landed. There's parts of Kansas in the central western part that cannot irrigate anymore. So we can either try to respond now with some wise controls, or we can just keep going until there's no more water. If we respond now and preserve what water is left in the aquifer, then we can deal with what we're going to be seeing over the next decades and hundreds of years as climate change takes a larger toll.
And do you think, based on what you're seeing, both in terms of the response from the folks who live out there and from government, is enough being done, or are we falling short?
No, I don't think anywhere near enough is being done, and I don't really think the state government has the power to do it, but I don't think it's politically expedient. I don't think they're going to shut down irrigation on the Western Plains. But I do think that the federal government has the power to make some changes. For instance, they could rescind the ethanol mandate, which most people don't believe that ethanol is much good for the environment at all. It takes about as much fossil fuel to make a gallon as it replaces. And then also the farm program, instead of subsidizing crops, right now the subsidies come mainly through crop insurance, but instead of subsidizing crops that are not meant for that region and require too much water, we should switch over to subsidizing dry land crops that only need a little bit of irrigation.
Julene Baer is the author of The Ogallala Road, A Memoir of Love and Reckoning. Again, she speaks tonight at 7 o'clock at Unity Temple on the Country Club Plaza. To grab a seat, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. What a pleasure to have you here.
It was wonderful.
Having you.
I really enjoyed being here. Thank you, Steve.
Good luck with the book.
Okay, thanks.